I remember pledging when I was about 12 years old to be a missionary's wife. And I thought my entire identity would be in serving my husband's ministry. But I went from this very extreme end and swung to the opposite end of the pendulum. When I was in eighth grade, I transferred into public schooling for the first time. And it took me a couple of years, but I started to figure out what it is that I needed to do to fit in. By the time I was in 10th grade, you know, I had met a boy who was well known. He was a football player and started partying and drinking shortly thereafter. And at that point was doing the complete opposite of all of those beliefs.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to In My Non-Expert Opinion. This is your host, Chelsea Reif, and I help people launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts. So remember a few weeks ago where I was like, we are shifting gears into sex, relationships, dating. And then I started to talk a little bit about how sexuality and spirituality overlap. And what does that mean? Can you actually say those two words together? As someone who grew up with a Spanish Catholic mom and from the South, which is just very driven by Christianity, and then who lived in Utah for a year in a Mormon community, religion and spirituality and sex always feel like a sticky subject to me. No pun intended. But truly, I've always been like, I don't know how to talk about these things. I feel like I'm not being a quote unquote good girl. I feel like I'm not being spiritual if I'm drinking on the weekend or hooking up with guys and having casual situationships and all these modern day dating dynamics. And so I thought I need to bring someone in who has a bigger world view of relationship dynamics and how they work. So today's guest is Courtney Brooke. Courtney is a licensed social worker and trauma-informed behavioral health therapist. As an integrative practitioner, Courtney uses holistic approaches to treatment that include breathwork and visualization, among others. In addition to running groups and working with private clients at Serenity Hill Counseling, Courtney serves her community at her local hospital on the adult psychiatric unit. She lives in Southwest Pennsylvania along with her husband, two children, and their two cats. Courtney is going to share her experience with trauma, religion, and sex work. She actually shares how sex work affected her relationships and self-worth, and the stigmatization and misconceptions surrounding sex work. The more and more I travel, the more I expand my perspective into the dynamics that are possible, not only with sex work, but in relationships. So Courtney's going to take us behind the scenes of that whole world, and she's going to share her tools for healing, including therapy and self-reflection, and how she's currently a therapist and spiritual guide. So talk about sex and spirituality. I think Courtney is the perfect embodiment and the perfect guest to have on. So buckle up, get ready. This is truly a conversation I have not had on this podcast before, and I think you're going to find it very eye-opening to hear about open relationships, sex work, trauma, religion, and healing from your past to move forward. Hello, hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. I am so freaking excited about today's guest, Courtney Brooke. Welcome to the show. We are so excited to have you.
I am so excited to be here. I am all into the taboo, and I love talking about the things that people don't like to talk about. So I'm excited to dive into this topic with you today, Chelsea.
Oh, we are going to have such a good time. Actually, you are probably the first guest out of like almost 200 episodes I've done where we're diving into spirituality, sex, sex work, open relationships, religion, and like how all these things have overlapped and fucked us up and opened us up. Like, we're going to go so many ways today. And I'm just like, everyone buckle up. We are going on a wild ride today.
Yes. I literally live for this stuff. I'm really into astrology and my Mars is in Gemini in the eighth house. And I was born during a Mercury retrograde. So quite literally live for this shit.
Oh, I cannot wait. So for anybody that doesn't know what you do, can you give us a little background of what you do and who you serve?
Yeah. So I'm a therapist. I am an integrative therapist. So I work from a mind-body-spirit approach. I'm trained as a social worker. I worked in a medical setting and inpatient psych. So I've worked in some of the darkest places, so to speak. Beside that, I'm also a spiritual guide and a mentor. I run a lot of local groups in Pennsylvania, and I'm a wife and a mom.
Okay, love that. I also want to shout out that you're a therapist, you're a mom, you help so many different people. Like, a mom in and of itself is a full-time job. Therapy, like you just said, been in some of the darkest places, is
also something that's just so emotionally and can be mentally draining. How do you balance that?
Well, it took a lot of hard work and effort. And, you know, I say I wear a lot of different hats. Honestly, my favorite hat to wear is being a wife. I love my partner. I can honestly say that he's my absolute best friend. He's my favorite person in the world. But it took us a long time to get there. And it's been through a lot of self-reflection and inner work and trying to achieve balance, because for a long time, I had this image of what it meant to be a wife, what it meant to be a mom. And I tried so hard to be perfect, right? To just have it all the right way. And a lot of that stems from my religious upbringing. But through the hard work of self-reflection and lots of therapy, lots of shadow work and community, I have been able to come to a place where I found a really great balance in my life.
I love that. Can you take us back to before you were doing this type of work? What do you think led you on this path?
Well, I feel like I've always been in love with humanity. Even from the time that I was a little girl, I've just been fascinated by people and their stories. And I am somebody who has lived experience when it comes to trauma. I was abused as a very small child by a caregiver, and I developed a lot of anxiety as a result. I was always a very anxious child, very isolated. And after everything came out about the caregiver, my parents had turned to religion. And I practiced as a fundamental independent Baptist for about 8 years, which, if you don't know anything about fundamentalism, just know that it is a very, very strict adherence to biblical principles. It does not leave any room for questioning. It is very black and white. I was taking marriage and motherhood classes when I was 10 years old.
Wow.
It really shaped me as a human.
Can you just tell us, like, what is a marriage and motherhood class at 10 feel like, or what were you actually learning?
You know, I have revisited those moments often. And in retrospect, I feel like I knew that there was something always wrong about it. I remember being taught how to prioritize your husband and your children's needs above your own. Talked a lot about the biblical woman in the book of Proverbs, you know, that woman who is so graceful and just gives and gives. I was taught like how to do laundry, how to cook, housekeeping things. And it's so fascinating to look back at that. And you wonder why it is that they felt the need to teach girls how to be wives and mothers, despite the fact that we've been wives and mothers since the beginning of time. But of course, that patriarchal thinking, there's a right and a wrong way to do it. And they had to make sure we did it the right way.
This is going to open up like a whole can of worms. And I'm just so curious, how do you think that type of teaching and thinking affected your current relationship, or did it?
Oh, very deeply. I think it affected every relationship that I've ever had. And, you know, for me, it was interesting. So I went from one extreme of perfectionism and believing that I could only have one partner in my lifetime, and that would be my husband, and my whole life would be wrapped up in him. And, you know, I remember pledging when I was about 12 years old to be a missionary's wife. And I thought my entire identity would be in serving my husband's ministry. But I went from this very extreme end and swung to the opposite end of the pendulum. When I was in eighth grade, I transferred into public schooling for the first time. I had been privately schooled, parochial school up until that point. And it took me a couple of years, but I started to figure out what it is that I needed to do to fit in, which by the time I was in 10th grade, you know, I had met a boy who was well known. He was a football player and started partying and drinking shortly thereafter. And just at that point was doing the complete opposite of all of those beliefs. Unfortunately, that turned out to be an abusive relationship. There's a lot of interpersonal violence. It ended with a protection from abuse order. We took it to court. I mean, just a really difficult situation. And at that point, I really fell into a deep, dark depression for the first time in my life. I experienced suicidality, and after I went to inpatient hospitalization, I came out, and although I would love to say that it changed my life and I was all better and everything at 17, that just wasn't the case. I started drinking even more heavily and partying even harder and trying to escape the depression and escape the anxiety. And in my relationships with other people, in retrospect, I see that my value and my worth was all tied up in how well I could please the people around me. Was I funny enough? Was I outgoing enough? And it became almost like a competition to be like better at partying, in a sense, to be like the perfect partier. I don't know how else to describe it, but it definitely has affected every single relationship. And even through my healing journey, and I did fortunately get away from the drugs and alcohol. I was using a lot of heavy substances into my early 20s. But even subsequently, subconsciously, I do still to this day find some of that old programming that pops up around that not enoughness. And it's important to know that in this type of work and along this healing journey, that ideally, yes, we want these beliefs to go away. We want them to disappear into the oblivion or whatever. But for a lot of us who have that really, really deep programming, it's not always reasonable to just expect it to go away. And instead, it's creating an awareness around it. So when it pops up, you can go, ah, I see you and I don't believe you.
Can you walk us through some of the tools that you use to start your healing journey?
Yeah, I think that the number one thing for me was definitely therapy. Even very early on, when I was 18, 19, 20 years old and still partying heavily, I had a therapist who, you know, helped guide me and learning to at least start to question and critically think about some of my thoughts. This is going to probably be a little surprising to hear, but truthfully, you know, alcohol and drugs were a very valuable tool for me when I was super early in my journey. And there's a lot of stigmatization around that. And certainly, I think it's important to differentiate between the tools that are short-term versus long-term. So in the short-term, the alcohol, those late nights, partying with my friends, those early college days, those were the things that kept me alive when I didn't even really want to be here. So was it ideal for me to be like out partying until 2 or 3 a.m.? No. But it was better than sitting in my dorm room and contemplating suicide, which were, I mean, that's the point that I was at. So I say that we all do the best we can with the tools that we have and what's ever accessible. So in those early days, all I had was my therapist and my drinking. And that's what I used early on.
So walk us through after high school and even maybe starting with the therapist, like what was the next step in Courtney's upbringing or like coming of youth, so to speak?
Well, I think that it's important to know that I relied heavily on my friends, and I at one point was in a predicament. I was in college. I had partied really, really hard my freshman year, and I lost a scholarship. And without that scholarship, I was faced with a dilemma where I needed to come up with about $3,000 or $4,000 in the matter of like a month or two. And I grew up in poverty. I'm a first generation college student. I did not have $3,000 or $4,000 lying around. But what I did have was a friend who told me that I could make that in a matter of a couple weeks if I needed it. And my friend, her mother was a dancer. She was a stripper. And that was when I started to professionally dance of sorts. I'd always enjoyed dancing. It was nice to have that positive attention, right? The little people pleaser in me loved that people loved me. And so that's when I first dived into sex work and into the world of dancing, partying, those late nights. There was a lot of what I would refer to as maybe meaningless sex. So to be clear, I was not a prostitute or anything like that. And I don't judge the women who made that choice. And certainly there were women who were doing that. But these were guys that I met in the club who were fun. And, you know, I'd go home with them. And there was a moment that I realized, probably about 2 years into it, that as much as I really enjoyed the work and I loved the attention, I loved the money. I mean, Chelsea, we're talking $500 an hour. $500 an hour. Oof. At 20 years old?
That's like $1 million at 20 years old.
Exactly. And, you know, sex work is real work. That's the part that I maybe didn't realize at first, was how much it can take out of you. And that, like, I'm a very empathic person, like, just naturally in my core. I'm in human design. I have all of my centers open pretty much, except for my throat and my G center. So I'm super easily conditioned. I am always taking in other people's energies. And in that setting, there was a lot of energies that were harming me. And I don't think that it's the case for everybody else, but in my case, I had started to become conditioned to be somebody that I wasn't. So I was lying, I was stealing, I was manipulating. I didn't care as long as I got the money. And that's not who I am. I'm a very ethical person in my core. And altruism is actually one of my core values. So after a little bit of time, I realized that I was out of alignment there. And it was an emotional moment. It was a very emotional moment because I'm all for female empowerment. Like, girl, make your money. And, you know, in retrospect, if there was a way that I could have done it, that would have been in alignment, that would have been great. But after a few years, I danced for a total of about 3 years. I realized I couldn't continue along that path.
I have a question around this time of your life. How close were you with your family?
So here's the thing that I think makes me a little bit unique in comparison with other sex workers. So I know that a lot of sex workers are disconnected from their families. A lot of them have no support from mom, dad, siblings. They've been disowned. They're the black sheep. I was fortunate that my family always loved and supported me completely unconditionally. I even remember there was a time where they had tried to intervene with me. At this point, I was using a lot of heavy substances. I was actually technically homeless at the time. I was just floating around to people's houses. I was living out in the city in Pittsburgh. And, you know, they tried to sit me down and, Courtney, what are you doing? And just come home. We love you. And why are you using all these drugs? And I remember, like, looking at them and being like, every drug that I take expands my consciousness. And I want to have the most expanded consciousness possible. And you just don't understand. You can't possibly understand. And even in that moment, there was this feeling of being held and in being loved. And I am unique in that way. And I think that I had a bounce back because of their unconditional love and support. And for the record, folks, there are many ways to expand your consciousness. Drugs are one way of doing that, but there are lots of modalities. And as much as I kind of had blinders on and was very much in that, what I would refer to as a hedonistic lifestyle at that point, my family never once disowned me, cut off contact, nothing like that.
You know what's interesting is, as I asked the question, as you started answering, I realized, like, there's kind of this closed-minded way of my thinking that you just kind of mentioned, like, oh, if you get into sex work, you're not close to your family. And there's that comes from the conditioning of, like, oh, you know, you must not be a good girl then. Like, no wonder you got into this bad stuff. And it goes back to that black and white thinking of, like, there's good and there's bad. And, like, you know, what guy, going back to your, you know, marriage and motherhood class, like what guy would marry a stripper, and strippers, you know, are dirty. And there's all these things we hear about sex work. And I'm curious, like, what were some of maybe the most hurtful or just not true things that you experienced when you were dancing?
You know, I got a lot of guys who were very surprised by the fact that I'm a bright girl. I'm very intelligent. And I would have people say things like, what is a girl like you doing here? Or like, you're so smart. Why would you be doing this? And in my mind, I'm like, yeah, I'm fucking smart. And that's why I'm making $500 an hour, homie. And, you know, I had a lot of coworkers who would have assumptions about like what it would mean to be someone who's still in contact with your family. Like they would be surprised, right? They'd be like, wow, like you're still in contact with your parents. And I think that some of the women who work in an event, they do shame themselves in that way. And they isolate themselves and they disconnect from others out of shame and out of guilt. And that doesn't have to be true. Like it doesn't have to be one or the other. You can both make money in sex work and you can still have love and support from friends and family. You don't have to hide. So that does tie in with that black and white thinking of, it's kind of like you can't have the best of both worlds, right? But it's a misconception that women have to be isolated like that. I know plenty of women when I was working in there who were married, who were mothers, who were professionals, women who had job titles and would go and do that work in the evenings and on the weekends. And I think that's a really common misconception that it must just be this one type of girl, the bad girl, the black sheep, but that's not necessarily the case.
It brings up the documentary I remember watching. Have you seen it called Hot Girls Wanted?
I don't think I have.
So it's on, I think it's on Netflix, and it talks about the porn industry and like just follows a few people and like how they get into it and how their parents find out and like how some people end up doing scenes that like they don't really want to. And there's another girl that comes out of a scene and she's like, oh, that kind of felt gross. It obviously it's a documentary. So it's, there's always like a little bit of bias. And I think it's content like that, again, that's what we think like, oh, poor girl. Like she got stuck in this situation and she's desperate and like doesn't know how to get out of it. Or she's just not educated. And to hear stories like yours, like there's women that are married, there's women with job titles with college degrees, like very intelligent women that are doing this for no other reason to just have an extra income. I'm curious, did you ever experience any shame or any aha moment that you were like, why am I here? Like, what am I doing? Like, did you judge yourself?
You know, there was some of that happening. And ultimately, I think it's that led me away from it. Now, I don't want to sugarcoat the fact that there are some pretty maybe damaged women, right? There are those, I think of them as like the poor lost soul, and not as in a pity way, but you know, like I remember there was a girl who would ask me to stand guard for her while she would shoot up in the back. And you know, there were girls who would tell, like ask me to keep watch and make sure that there was like a house mom, we would call them, wouldn't come in so that they could give a BJ and get the extra money. And, you know, like there were those girls in that setting. And while I didn't partake in that, I was never an intravenous user. I didn't provide sex in that kind of setting. I did kind of get like the effect of being close to it, I think, that just watching it and seeing it transpire made me question, like, am I like that? Am I like these girls? And, you know, now, years later, as a therapist, I'm like, that was, first of all, judgment that wasn't fair to do. I always say that we should sit in awe of the burdens that humans can carry rather than in judgment of how they choose to carry it. A lot of those girls were women who were sexually abused as children, who dealt with domestic violence, who literally needed, it was life or death, that extra couple hundred dollars. And some of the only ways they could get through that was through using the drugs to help numb some of that emotion. So yeah, there was a lot of self-judgment, I think, There was a lot of shame around it. And I have come to a place where I actually look back on that part of my life in fondness. And I'm really grateful for that experience. It was one of the funnest times of my life. As dark as it got, I have so many memories that I would never trade for the world. And I even have people ask me, you know, I have friends who are sex workers still, and they do OnlyFans. And a lot of them will ask me, why don't you go back to it? Like, you can do it online. You can do it anonymously. Like, you have all these options. And I tell them the same thing every time, which is, sex is recreational for me now. I don't need to get paid to do it. It's fun and it's easy. And I can say that without having self-judgment or shame around it. And that's something that wasn't always the case for me.
Religious trauma, I feel like, is something that I have never ever talked about on this show. And it's coming to mind right now because you brought up that you have this religious background and that you were going to classes that were very much, this is how you be a good wife and a good mom and you give, give, give. And it sounds like people that were in that room with you hearing that you ended up dancing would be like, oh, she was not getting the memo, right? Like, she didn't follow the Lord's path or what we think. And I'm curious, like, was there a moment in time that you were like, screw this, I'm throwing this all in the trash? Or did religion play, or faith, or anything play a part in some of your later, like, college years and even post-college? Like, I'm curious, where's the overlap between religion and what you were doing in the sex work world?
Yeah. So Ernest Becker, he's an anthropologist, and he was a very eccentric man. And he wrote a book that's called The Denial of Death. And it's a great read. It's a little dense. But in that book, he talks about how, as humans, we have learned to look with disgust at the parts of us that are animalistic, or really the most human parts of us. And I certainly think that sex falls under that category. We are mammals. And we can't necessarily control how we feel as far as attraction or that sexual desire. It's a very impulsive thing. And I think that a lot of people just don't even recognize it then, right? It gets shoved back to the corner of their mind, especially in religious context. It's for procreation, not for pleasure. And I realize in retrospect that that is exactly what is happening in a lot of religious contexts. The human parts of us, we meet with disgust and with fear. And truthfully, we're still having a human experience, and it's happening for a reason. We're meant to experience pleasure. And it's a huge part of my healing journey to be able to embrace that. So fast forward to about the time that I was about 25, 26 years old. I had just been married, and my husband and I were running into some rocky issues in our marriage. And I started going to counseling again. And at that point, we had grown a bit of a disconnection. And in my marriage, I wasn't finding satisfaction. I wasn't finding pleasure. And for the first time in my life, I found myself contemplating cheating or infidelity. I was very fortunate that the person that I reached out to, who I was trying to seduce, was a very good human being and was like, no go. He was a dear friend from college, and he was respectful towards me in that moment. And I explored this with my therapist, and I'm like, what is happening? I don't understand this. Why am I feeling this way? What is wrong with me? And I came to realize that, you know, again, this is coming back to this place that we fear sexuality. So why would I be looking outside of a marriage? Well, because I wasn't happy. And as humans, we have a certain level of need. And if that need isn't met, then it's a very human thing. It's a very animalistic thing to say, okay, well, how do I get this need met in a different way? And, you know, at first I was like, oh, am I just like sexually deviant? Am I just a slut? Like, am I just meant to be this type of person? Maybe this isn't the right marriage. Maybe it needs to, I need to be with somebody who's more open. And my therapist was like, Courtney, there is no such thing as sexual deviancy. If you look at the research, everybody's having these thoughts and everybody's sort of fantasizing about the same things. And when we talk about people who cheat, even in instances of rape and sexual abuse and all of that, truly, all of that comes from this place of repression and taboo. I truly believe that it's in our cultural repression and our unwillingness to talk about sex and to talk about our instincts and desires that creates the circumstances necessary to cheat or to abuse others sexually. If we're open, right? If we can talk about it, if you can go to your husband or your wife and say, hey, I'm starting to feel this impulse towards other people. I'm not really happy with our sex life. I'm not satisfied in this. Then we can alleviate that impulse. We can start to talk about, well, what is it that we need to do to create that connection between us again? And, you know, I don't necessarily think that monogamy works for every person. I think that for some people that non-monogamy makes sense, especially when you're talking about people who are nomadic, who travel a lot, or you talk about people who have a very large sex drive. But it's really in that repression of, we don't talk about this, we don't explore this, this is taboo, that religious pressure of just one person and all of that is ultimately what leads to the infidelity, to the sexual abuse, to rape, all of those things in the end.
You know, what's so interesting is, to your point, like if you look at animals and mammals and everything, I think like the only animal that's monogamous is the penguin. Like, I think that's something I learned in Cape Town. And I am curious if you know from your own experience and research, like, why did humans start to become monogamous? Like, when did that happen?
So evolutionary psychology theorizes that humans decided to become monogamous because of lack of resources. So it didn't make sense for women to have multiple partners when resources were very limited and offspring didn't survive a lot of the time. So you needed that one-to-one partnership essentially to survive. And you needed a partner who was focused on you and you alone, because if he had to spread that resource among multiple women, that would mean less for you. So evolutionarily, monogamy developed as a result of a lack of resources and that survival state that fortunately isn't really the case in modern society anymore.
Why did we never go back to what it was before?
So I'm actually going to challenge that thought. I don't necessarily think that we haven't gone back. I think that it has always just remained behind closed doors. I think that there are a lot of instances of infidelity. I think there are even cultures that have started to embrace that. French culture is a great example of that, where it is very normal to have multiple partners. And the newest trend that we're seeing is around ethical non-monogamy. So I do couples counseling, and I counsel a number of couples on ethical non-monogamy. And I think that as a human species, you're going to see evolutionarily that we do begin to sort of move beyond this one-to-one. And what I would offer with that is that it's important to distinguish and to be very mindful around, why is it that I desire to have more than one partner? I think that the term casual sex can be a bit of an oxymoron, in a sense, simply because sex is a very powerful thing and it's a very sacred thing. And I think that there's always an exchange of power when we have sex. There is somebody who is giving and there is somebody who is receiving the power. And if we're not aware of that power dynamic, there's a really good chance that we might be the one giving it away. And it's important to be mindful and to be purposeful. Why am I doing this? Am I doing this from this place of insatiability, where I'm trying to fill a hole, where I'm trying to prove my own worth or people pleasing with it? I mentioned Ernest Becker in his book, The Denial of Death. He says that, you know, sex is a very disappointing answer when it comes to the human existence and why we're here. It's important that we have pleasure and play, but it's equally important that we have balance. So if we're doing it for fun, for pleasure, for play, that's one thing. Sex can be a really healthy coping skill. I always say there's three major ways that our body releases: through crying, through laughter, and through coming. Those are all wonderful ways of expressing ourselves. But if we're doing anything mindlessly, including having sex, that can backfire. So it's important to kind of distinguish, like, why is it that I'm doing this?
Ethical non-monogamy is something that you said that we're starting to see more people talk about, open relationships. I had no idea how many people were open to them until I started traveling with Remote Year and other type of travel programs and just meeting people. And I've met multiple people now in open relationships. Funny enough that you said French, the two guys I'm thinking of are two French guys. And it kind of shocked me because you see it, you hear about it sometimes on podcasts or like, I don't know, it seems like this other world if you come from a smaller town, especially one that has like religious roots in it. I'm from Florida. There's a lot of religion in Florida, a lot of religious trauma in Florida. And I think there are people listening right now that are going to say ethical non-monogamy is just a cop-out to cheat, or it's just a way for a partner to like get away with something instead of like facing their feelings or going to therapy, or like they're not actually talking it out. And I'm curious, like, what would you say to someone like that?
What I would say is that you don't have the right to determine other people's rules within their relationship. And what two people decide upon in their relationship is none of your business.
Amen.
First and foremost, keep your judgment in check. Just because you don't understand it does not mean that it doesn't make sense for other people. The other thing that I would explain to them is that ethical non-monogamy exists on a spectrum just like anything else. So the whole open relationship, that sort of swingers mentality, that is on one extreme of this spectrum. And that is where a lot of people only understand. Like, they just think, oh, these are people who just go around and have sex with everybody, right? But that isn't the case. I have a couple that I'm counseling where the wife has a chronic illness and sex isn't reasonable for her to be able to do. They have a very loving, a very intimate relationship on so many other levels. But he does have a girlfriend that he has sex with in order to meet that need. And they're in this mutual understanding and this respect of, she has a chronic illness, this is not reasonable to ask of her. And rather than terminating that relationship and leaving his partner that he cares and loves so deeply, instead they've been able to explore an alternative way of having that need met. And I think that's just a really beautiful example of how, once again, you don't own the rule book here. You don't get to tell other people what makes sense or what works in their relationship. This swingers or this open relationship, that works for some people. But understand that even in those contexts, a lot of times there are these sort of golden rules that people have in place. So on the other side of the spectrum, we have people who are monogamish. So these are people who have a clear primary partner. A lot of times they're married, they have families, but perhaps they're voyeurists who love to go to the sex club just to engage in front of other people. That is still a method of ethical non-monogamy. There are other persons involved in that relationship in a certain way. There are people along that spectrum who are polyamory, who fall more towards the middle, where they actually have love for multiple partners. And it's not this casual or like this open, because a lot of times in those open relationships, they have a rule, like you don't fall in love, right? It stays casual. Whereas polyamory is the recognition that I have enough love to share with multiple partners. And people who engage in that type of polyamory, sometimes they're sexual and sometimes they're not. Sometimes they have a sexual partner and then they also have a lover that they are intimate with on an emotional level. And they may or may not be having sex with that person. So I think that people have one idea of what it looks like. It's like the pineapple, the swingers, and that is not the case. This is a spectrum. And what, just because something doesn't make sense for you doesn't mean that it doesn't make sense for somebody else.
Right. I think people need to put themselves in other shoes just the way someone in an open relationship is making that work for them. They could be judging you, being like, I can't believe this person's just in a heterosexual single person partnership. And imagine if you were just like, wait, what? That's just what I like. And that's what I want for my life. And someone just kept telling you, you're wrong. You must not be well. You must not be close to your family. Like all the other things, you'd just be like, wait, no, this is just how I am. It's really hard for people to accept that truth because of the media, because of patriarchy, because of religion, because of so much, I mean, millennia of conditioning around like, this is how it is and this is how it's supposed to be. And I'm happy to see people having conversations and people like you bringing it up to show us that, yeah, we don't own the rule book and we're allowed to do whatever the hell we want. It's our life. Something you brought up too is the spectrum, which again, I was closed-minded to open relationships and still, until I started talking to one of the guys that was in one. And in my mind, I was thinking that way of like, oh, he just wants it. So while he's traveling, he can like cheat and he doesn't have to like actually deal with any consequences. We started talking and I'm like, that could not be further from the truth. He is like, I have to have the most honest, open, direct communication with my current girlfriend. We have to put every card on the table all the times. We have strict boundaries, strict rules, what we can and can't do. And sometimes an open relationship is just like a hall pass for the year. It's like, I just want to be able to like once a year go out and hook up with someone, where some people, like you just said, are like, no, I have multiple partners all the time. I thought it was genuinely like one way and it was just to like get away with being with another person. So this whole idea of the spectrum is something I really want people to like take in and consider, that this could even work for you and your current partner listening, whoever's listening right now. And you're like, oh, like I didn't realize there were so many ways to do this. And there's so many like exciting ways to explore this. Let's say someone is listening right now and they're like, I really want to bring this up to my partner, but I don't want to hurt their feelings or like make them feel jealous. What would you say?
Yeah. Well, I'll be honest when I say that whenever I first started to consider some of this around the time where I had been thinking about cheating, when my husband and I were struggling, you know, we went to the therapist, we talked about it, and she was like, I do not recommend that you guys do that. Because it requires a very clear communication. Like you have to have really super, super good communication skills. And we were not there. So I think that for people who have a very deep understanding and are very secure and developed in their connection, that prerequisite of we have a very solid relationship, we're very clear with one another, that would have to happen before you can have that conversation, right? Now, I do think it's important that we acknowledge the stigmatization that comes with these impulses, right? What is wrong with me? Why would I feel like this? And know that in order to break down that stigma, the best way that we can do that is by having those types of conversations. And for that, I would recommend if you're somebody who's having this impulse or wanting to question this, consider couples counseling, because it creates a container and it brings in a mediator for those types of conversations who can stop and help identify any distorted thinking. Oh, you think that if they're attracted to somebody else, that that means they're less attracted to you or they're less interested in you. Is that true? Not necessarily, right? You can feel attraction to multiple people, and that doesn't change anything about that connection that they have with you. But sometimes you do need like that third party sort of weighing in or monitoring the situation and making sure it doesn't go off the rails. But I definitely say that probably before you want to have those types of conversations, you want to make sure that you are very much securely attached to one another. You've got to make sure you have really good communication skills. You have those assertive communication, I statements, all of that good stuff before you even really want to consider anything like that. The only exception that I would make to that is if you are somebody who's casually dating and you are just getting to know people and you're interested in this type of lifestyle, it's okay in those situations. It may even be a good idea to be able to approach with, hey, I'm into alternative lifestyles and I'm interested in ethical non-monogamy. How do you feel about that? And letting that be something that you're open and honest about from the get-go. But if you're somebody who's already in a long-term relationship or you've been with somebody for a little while, it is certainly something that you have to be very mindful and purposeful around.
I have a friend that wrote in, I know any relationship dynamic exists, but this is one that him and I have had an argument on, and I don't know why it really like triggered me, and I'm curious to hear just your take or what you think about it. He would love the idea of him being open in the relationship, but not his partner. Again, I'm sure dynamics like that exist, but to me, I was like, oh, it just feels like you get to have your cake and eat it too, and your partner doesn't. But I'm like, am I being closed-minded? And I probably am. And so, yeah, I'm just curious to hear your thoughts. And he wrote in and asked, does that dynamic work, or have you seen that dynamic work before?
So what he's referring to is a polygyny, or basically the assumption that the man can have multiple partners, but the woman cannot. A lot of that comes from stigmatization and judgment around female sexuality. And the idea that women are tainted when they engage with multiple partners or with somebody outside of that individual that they're in a relationship with. So could it work? In theory, possibly. What I would challenge and say is it probably won't work well because there's a lot of unconscious bias that's happening in that situation, in that sense of that partner will perceive themselves as being less entitled to pleasure and being less entitled to exploration, and that their need or their want may not be as valid as a man's need or want in that situation. So I would say that is unfair to the woman who is just as entitled and just as valid in her desires. If you have a woman as a partner who's not interested in that, that's okay, right? I'm not making the rule book. You get to write your own rule book within your relationship. I've never seen that in practice. I can't say that that's something I've witnessed, but I think that is a very common thing that you hear from men is, well, I would be okay. I know it wouldn't change anything about my relationship with her, but it would change the way that I view her if she were to do that. And then I go, all right, so you got a lot of unconscious bias going on. That's what we're talking about now.
Wow. Okay. So much to think about and reflect on here. And you've obviously referenced your relationship with your husband. And I'm curious, can you tell us how you guys met and then how you ultimately decided to get married?
Yeah. So it's very interesting. Our relationship was very complicated to begin. He was in a relationship with somebody else and I was in a relationship with somebody else. And in fact, I was friends with his 5-year long-term girlfriend. And there was certainly a connection there to begin with. And I would say that at that point, I was definitely in that mindset of black and white. So I mentioned that when we're in that mindset, that's what creates the circumstances for cheating, right? So frankly, straight up, you know, he was cheating. He was cheating on his girlfriend with me. And it was a very difficult transition from leaving those relationships and deciding to be monogamous with one another. We dated briefly my freshman year for a couple of months, but again, I was cheating. And while he wasn't quite aware of that, that does reflect in a relationship, right? There's a part of that person subconsciously who recognizes, like, you're not here 100%. And that had created that dynamic where he withdrew from the relationship. He ended the relationship after a couple of months. But him and I always had just a very, very deep connection. I remember when he broke up with me that first time, I literally vomited. And I'm not even exaggerating. Like, I was so sick to my stomach. I'm a very spiritual person. I'm a very intuitive person. And I just knew that this person was meant to be in my life. So it was really, really difficult, that breakup. And honestly, that's what led me into my journey as far as sex work, because I kind of bottomed out. Like, he was my best friend. And I was like, if I showed my best friend every part of me and he still didn't love me and he didn't want to be with me, then what does that mean about me? So we separated after about a year or so. He reached back out to me and basically just said, like, I cannot quit thinking about you. And it was very good timing in that this was right at the same time where I had decided to get clean and I had moved back home with my family. And honestly, that summer I was celibate the entire summer. I had decided to just really focus on myself and my growth through those couple of years of dancing. I had actually dropped out of school. Very ironic, considering I had started dancing so I could get money to stay in school. And then beyond that, we reconnected. I had done a lot of personal growth and finally gotten to the point where I was ready for a relationship. So we reconnected in 2012, at the end of 2012. And we dated for 5 years. We had a child. We had my son during that time. And then we decided to get married. And it was something that we never actually planned on. I'll be honest, we had always kind of, we're a little like non-traditional. My husband considers himself an anarchist, and I don't necessarily prescribe to a lot of these traditional things. But his mother was really sick. She had cancer, advanced stage lung cancer. And we both looked at each other and we were like, will we ever get married? Because if we're going to, we should probably do it while she's still with us. And so we did decide to get married. We got married in 2017. And we lost her shortly after. So that was a really good decision on our end. But truthfully, it still was an odd dynamic. Like, there was still this parts of ourselves that we were hiding from each other. And I had basically gotten to the point where I was working as a waitress while my grad program. And I would end up staying late with my friends after I was done with my shift. And just getting shit-faced. Like, I would just get wasted. And it was always about him. Like, I would always blame it on him. And, you know, I reflect on that time period and I go, well, there was my shadows, right? Those were the parts of me that I couldn't share with him. I couldn't share with him the parts that I wasn't happy with, that I wasn't satisfied with within the relationship. And our shadows have a way of coming out and finding a way to make themselves known. And so for me, that was drinking until the early hours of the morning, complaining about my old man and all that crap. But, you know, we finally realized that this was heading in a really bad direction. And at that point, that's when we got into couples counseling. You know, I sort of had an emotional affair, I would say, at that point. And we started discussing those things in couples counseling. And I finally started showing him some of these shadows and, like, you know, these are some of the desires I'm having. These are some of the thoughts that I'm having. And we started to explore and dabble a little bit more. Now, I will say that my husband and I are not swingers and we do not have an open relationship. We are certainly more on that monogamish end of the spectrum. And I don't know that I necessarily need to share exactly how we practice, but just that we have our boundaries. You know, a lot of people, they try to pathologize that sort of thing. And they're like, oh, it's just a lack of boundaries. And you just, you know, you can't control your impulses and that sort of thing. But truthfully, if anything, it's brought us closer together. And it's very clearly bounded. Whereas before, there was a point where I was considering adultery, like on my husband. And I was able to instead come to a place where, hey, I can communicate this with you. And he didn't run away. He completely understood. But it was required for me to be able to take that step of no longer feeling shame around like being a woman who likes sex. And there's nothing wrong with that. And it's not a shameful thing. And I deserve pleasure just as much as a man does. And all women do.
Oh my gosh, I love that. You have been so incredibly open today and transparent and vulnerable and just so helpful in understanding some of these dynamics that, again, not a lot of people talk about or know about. And so I'm curious for like one last final piece of advice or wisdom or something you want people to know, a truth, what would that be?
I think the most important thing to know and understand about sex, and especially with females and orgasms and things like that, is that there is a certain amount of emotional safety that has to happen. And, you know, for a long time, I didn't actually think that I could orgasm with a partner. My husband was the first partner that I was able to do that regularly with. And in my journey, I've come to realize that a big part of the female sexual experience is feeling emotionally safe and that intimacy. And it doesn't have to be with this long-term partner, right? But even if it's a casual thing, having somebody that you feel safe with, that is really, really important. And when we talk about being sex positive and embracing that side of us, we're not just talking about this mindless or unbounded way of having sex, but rather understanding that sometimes the most sex positive thing we can do is choose not to have sex. And that this is not black and white, that it's certainly gray. And discernment is a huge, huge, huge part of this. Being mindful. Why am I doing this? Why am I wanting to explore this part? And making sure that you understand that why part of it.
I love that. Well, I ask every guest that's on this show, it's called In My Non-Expert Opinion. So what is something you're not an expert in that you wish that you were?
Honestly, podcasting, which is why you and I need to work together one of these days. I have my own podcast and it's very challenging and I don't completely understand it. And like, it's a little overwhelming. So I wish that I knew more about that.
Well, you know where to find me. I'm always here to help, but you are such a wealth of knowledge. This was truly so helpful. And I'm so glad we had this conversation. Like I said, I really haven't talked about any of this. So this is going to be a really exciting episode to air. If anyone wants to get in touch with you, how can they find you or work with you?
Yeah. So you can find me on Instagram. I'm at Courtney_Brooke_healing. You can also find me on any of the major podcast platforms. My podcast is called Nonlinear Healing with Courtney Brooke. So you can follow me along there. And as far as how you can work with me, at this point, all of my offerings are in person. I do telehealth in Pennsylvania, but aside from that, I run groups and do different spiritual workshops and things in the Westmoreland County in Pennsylvania. So
amazing. Well, thank you so much, Courtney, for coming on. This has been such an incredible conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Woo, that was a spicy one. Like I said, I am starting to dip my toe into these topics. And again, a lot of this has come from my travels and hearing how many people are in open relationships and have done sex work or are currently sex workers or carry a lot of religious trauma and shame around being a sexual human being. I think there's so much context and nuance that goes into these conversations. And I feel like Courtney is an example of someone who can start to help us really open up and be more comfortable around addressing these topics. Be sure to follow Courtney and her work. Check out all her links in the show notes. You know where to find me at Chelsea Rife on Instagram and ChelseaRife.com. And just a reminder, if you want to launch your own podcast, head to my website and click the mic drop link, because that is the ultimate podcast launch course teaching you everything you need to know A to Z about launching a podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and you're like, yes, please spill the tea, we need more of this type of content, DM me on Instagram or email me info@chelseareif.com and let me know what you want to hear more of. I am trying to interview OnlyFans stars. I'm trying to interview people in the BDSM scene. I would love to know who's been to Berghain and had sex at the club. Like, these are the conversations I want to start having. So if that's you, contact me, DM me. I'm so excited to really start to shift the podcast content a bit and expand our perspectives of the world and the relational dynamics that we all are involved in. All right, if you found value out of this episode, you know what to do. Head to Spotify, hit 5 stars, go to Apple Podcasts, write a review, scroll down all the way to the bottom where it says write a review, write that review, screenshot it, and then send it to info@chelseareif.com or at Chelsea Rife on Instagram, and I will enter you into a pool to win a laser coaching session with me. So that's 20 minutes one-on-one, my full undivided attention to pick my brain, ask about podcasting, get clear on what your goals are, whatever it is. All you have to do is leave a review on Apple Podcasts to be entered into this giveaway. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode.